Hello, Ernest.
Hello, Ernest. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Enjoying what looks like the end of the world.
Oh, yeah, the skies are orange.
Yes, this is September 10th, 2020, and today it's actually more of a dirty gray color, but yesterday it was just bright orange, and it looked like every movie I've ever seen about the world ending. There were infernos, asteroids, aliens, et cetera. The sky looks like it was on fire. So that was interesting. Ironically, the air quality wasn't that bad at ground level. It just looked really creepy.
Yeah, it does.
So I guess we can make a segue from pollution and air quality into hydrogen, one of your favorite topics.
We can discuss it in the subject of together with the subject of industrialization. Last week we talked about
Industrialism, I believe, was the phrase that Seth Godin was using as an alternative to
industrial.
capitalism in terms of the thing that is screwing up our world and our environment and our lives and relationships.
Correct.
Right.
In general, my view is that we should, together with my value of empowerment of the individual and communities, we should strive for scale, right scaling. This means scaling up or scaling down. And then the production of hydrogen as the basis of energy, both storage, production, and usage should be right scaled. So this what does this look like? When it comes to right scaling, for example, food production and meals, for centuries, for millennia, families can decide or have decided, how to grow food, how to prepare it. And in the modern day, we have, industrialized everything about food production. So this is to the benefit of, the owners of the machines and the systems that we use to grow food and produce it. But if
But
we
also the benefit of all of us who no longer have to work in the fields for in order to grow and feed ourselves. That's kind of a
yeah but
benefit.
yeah well that you if you view that as living in cities is the normal thing to do, living in our current situation, if you view that as this is the normal thing to do, then yeah, you talked about, okay, we need
Well, whether it's a healthy thing is a fair question to ask. But certainly from a voluntary perspective, history has shown for the most part when people have a choice between working on a farm and working on a in a subsistence level and working in a city for wages, the vast majority of people prefer wages to farm labor, subsistence farming.
That could be, but
Yeah.
my view is that we should move away from
So there's, there's. Still there? All
Go ahead, yeah.
right. So, but anyway, let's. So there are many people who benefit, and from industrialization of agriculture, and there certainly has been some negative consequences to it. We can stipulate that and move on.
So I see that the and my main problem is again the control that individuals and families and small groups and communities, they should control more closely whatever they need to perform their activities, be that eating, be that producing energy, be that manufacturing technology or using technology. Like right now, only the big, Intels and the AMDs and the ARMs and the Apples can produce computer chips, right? Because that's an industry that requires all
that
kinds of...
Well, that was about 5 years ago. It's changed in the last couple of years with RISC-V, but...
Oh, yes, RISC-V too, yeah. Like, but, you still need a whole bunch of industry and manufacturing to produce computer chips. I say that taking off, being scaling that technology so that fewer people are required to produce those things, or even to right scaling. Let's say you have a bunch of communities and they want to share technology, they can get together and produce their own technology. That way they are more in control over their technological future.
Right. So cooperative peer production is, and democratizing access to the means of production are worthy goals.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. So can I agree on that?
Yeah. So, and what does that give us? Well, that gives first more people will feel closer to the technology that they use. They wouldn't see them as aliens.
Okay, is
to their
that an
life.
Absolute good? That people feel closer to the technology they use?
Well, because at least in my experience, right?
I mean, do you really want to be closer to the plumbing that you use for sanitation?
Well, in one sense, yeah. In one sense, no.
I think that's good. It's good to slip apart. What are the senses in which this is a absolute good, and which are the senses in which this is a relative good?
An absolute good in the things that influence our lives, for example, technology, information technology, how we manage information, how we manage our interactions with our own data and with the with other entities, let's say governments. People are made to feel alienated because you have all kinds of bureaucracy and other processes that you're not. For example, your health data, right? This is something that should be very personal, and you should be as close to your health data as possible. But we have the system where you go to a hospital and they give you a whole bunch of paper with your information, or they give you, hey, if you want to see your information, you can go to this webpage and you can log in, and you have to create an account with that hospital or that hospital system to get your information. It's your information, but you have to log in into this another system through which you have to use to access your own information. And then you want to transfer that information somewhere else, right? Another hospital. And then there's some hospitals require paper. Some hospitals say, hey, fax us this information. Their computer systems, sometimes they're not compatible. So there's going to be a layer of translation or whatever process they have to go through, data entry, to transfer your information to our hospital. So all these, it's ways in which you are not in control over your own information. So
let me see if I can summarize what you're saying. So I think it's good to distinguish two things. One is that most people don't want to be intimate with the mechanics of the services we use, to have to manage all the low-level details. But we want to be in control of the values and the value of the systems we use. Is that a helpful distinction? If we'd like to make sure that our sanitation, for example, is happening in a way like the way that our waste is recycled, we should, whether we want to or not, be aware of the values that are being used in it, but we don't necessarily want to have to deal with the mechanics.
Well, yes, in one sense, that is correct. Yeah,
so like you don't want, like, you...
Go ahead.
Well, you know, for example, that, like, you're talking about, like, okay, it'd be nice if I could get the value out of my health record without necessarily having to deal with all the mechanics of how we copy and interoperate things between the systems, right? Because that's generally where things get tedious and you get information overload, is if you have to deal with all the mechanics. What you want is to be able to have them abstracted in a way that eliminates the tedium, but still allows you to express your values and ensure that the data is used in a way that's aligned with your values.
That is true. But then also knowing how the mechanics work, how they are implemented, is what would help you to trust the system. You know, a lot of people will tell you, I don't like dealing with this stuff because I don't trust it. I don't know what happens. I don't know who has my information. I don't know. You know, these are things that make you not trust the system. So if you are
transparency,
mm-hmm. and not only transparency,
people
but
want
also
visibility.
Control. Yes.
Right. So there's this interesting thing of, okay, so there's transparency, and let's call it scalable discovery and control. Right? Is that you'd like to be able to look at, you know, someone you trust and say this citizen system is certified, but if you doubt them, you should at least have the ability to dig into it and ideally fork the system if it's not actually behaving the way it says it does. So it's sort of fixable. Right. There is a tension there, right? But, you know, I think this gets to the issue of revocable delegation we talked about before, right? You don't want to have to deal with all the minutia all the time, but you want to have the authority to be able to say, hey, this is not working for me. Let me communicate that either so that someone who is knowledgeable takes me seriously and deals with it, or where I can fix it myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? So that is so I think that is it's sort of optional hackability of systems.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the challenge historically has been there were systems that were hackable because they had to be hacked in order to get them to work right. And so, you know, if you were to own a car 100 years ago, you had to become a skilled mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're at the other extreme where even if you're a skilled mechanic, you still can't hack your car because of all the systems. And one could argue that is the benefit of industrialization and industrialism is that it creates these layers of abstraction, but that's also the cost. And the question is what you want is hackable abstractions rather than, I guess, defensive abstractions, which are alienating abstractions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's
okay. So there's this principle thing about like we're in favor of hackable systems,
mm-hmm.
and democratizing access and hackability. So it's not just a small number of people with power who know what's going on in the systems or have the ability to control them or improve them. So I'm not sure how we get to hydrogen from there.
We get to with time and with open minds and get to the point where, oh, so we found out how to create this hydrogen production system that, you know, takes solar energy, you know, it has a bunch of batteries to store so that you can guarantee that there's always energy available. So we're going into the multiple, you know, flow batteries and other types of energy storage.
Sorry, I lost a step there. You're saying that in a world where we have perfected I guess solar electrolysis.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
Then in that world, then in theory, we have infinite hydrogen.
Yeah, you can say, or you know, almost infinite, or right? You get the
right. I mean, but I can make the same. Okay, but I mean, I can make the same thought experiment in a world where we have perfected battery technology and photovoltaic. We have infinite electricity. In a world where we've perfected safe nuclear, we have infinite electricity. There's several other scenarios of possible futures where we have near infinite power. And is there a particular reason you're picking hydrogen?
No. This applies to anything, you know, solar.
So in theory, if any power technology was perfected, we would have infinite amounts. Still not sure how this actually relates to your initial claim about hackable systems.
Well, my claim is like scalability. You know, more than hackable is like something can be scaled. Like a community can decide whether they want to buy their vegetables from or to get obtain their vegetables from some other outside entity, or they can decide, you know what, we're gonna grow our own vegetables either inside our homes or inside our buildings or outside in the field, whatever. They can make the decision themselves. So they will
let me just make sure I'm hearing you correctly. So what you're describing is a world, a way of organizing the world such that people say, you know, hey, I want to be able to choose to provide these essential services and functionality myself. I would also like to have the option to pay someone else to provide them if I think there's not something I'm particularly interested in doing, in a way where there's transparency and accountability. And conversely, it'd be nice if there's a way, like, I'm really, really good at this. I would like other people to pay me to do this for them because I'm honest, reliable, and trustworthy. And they don't really want the hassle of doing it themselves. And so is that a reasonable summary of what you're saying?
In my ideal world, it's more or less, it's less the pay me or I'll be paid for that, or
I will reward if you prefer. Like,
yes.
If I'm doing something really valuable for other people, they reward me. And if they're doing something valuable for me, I reward them.
Exactly. Just like within a family, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about a family. You know, people have their chores to do. If somebody can wash the dishes, you know, you're not going to say, hey, if you wash the dishes for me, I'm going to pay you some amount of money. No. You say, hey, can you wash the dishes for me? I can't. I have to do something else. Then,
no,
you know,
in my family, Ernest, it's very much like, hey, I know it's my turn to wash the dishes, but if you wash the dishes for me, I will watch the dog.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, with that.
But the reality is that there is unilateral gifting, right? Like parents for their children.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or we have a small puppy in our house, which is dominating our lives. And this puppy provides some intangible benefits in terms of affection and interaction. But generally, they are a massive sink and a drain. And in fact, my son, who's 12 years old, is wrestling very much with this question of how much of my life am I willing to sacrifice unilaterally for this puppy, even though I love him, versus wanting to have like sleep and time to play with my friends. And so, you know, the reality is that we have bonds of affection, which maybe gets to our definition of self. But even, you know, for any sustainable system, there needs to be, we talked about this in the Radical Centrist Manifesto, there's a sense in which we are rewarding others who create value for us.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you squint, what you're describing looks much... So it's interesting thing about Seth Godin's bugaboo of industrialism as kind of the villain of his piece. And the contrast of industrialism before that, though, is pastoralism. Right? It's a world where everyone lived in their own autonomous communities and, you know, were very close to the means of production.
Mm-hmm.
And what you discovered was that those systems were not stable because you would have raiders. If you were a prosperous community and you didn't have walls, then less prosperous communities would be tempted to steal from you.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually either you developed your own hierarchies to be able to mobilize them in battle, or you got conquered by someone who did. And that's the history of Western Europe and pretty much the rest of the world after Western Europe went into the Age of Expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Pastoralism is distributed. And so, you know, from Seth Nolan's viewpoint, what you're describing is basically, let's call it transparent capitalism. That his view is that, like, you know, it's a good thing that because the advantage of an open market is that you get to make autonomous decisions without someone telling you what you can and can't do. You can say, I can choose to grow my own food. I can choose to sell food. I can choose to buy food. And while there is, you know, downsides to all of those, you can't really escape those downsides entirely. The best you could hope for in this argument is, well, you need to have transparency about what's going on so people aren't able to take advantage of externalities or market inefficiencies. There's also what I would call the information compression effect of money. Like a price is, you know, this is Hayek, I think, in the Austrian school of economics. I'm never clear on all these different schools. But the idea is that a price is great because it efficiently compresses a whole bunch of different factors into a single variable that makes it easy to reason about. But as we've discovered, you know, like any compression algorithm or even any content moderation system, there is a cost to that. And that's why we have things like branding. So organic foods try to say, well, the price may be higher, but this other intangible is more valuable. And so there's this sort of constant arms race within the market economies. And the fact of the matter is that at scale, it's hard to imagine anything other than price and branding as being something that most people can consume, because we just can't make that many conscious, deliberate decisions all the time, right? If we had to actually, you know, try to, any single purchase, if you tried to understand all of the factors that go into it, you would go insane, right? Just the sheer, like, you know, pick any random item, the consequences in terms of the environment, in terms of labor, in terms of the value chain, it's nearly unimaginable. And frankly, even if you're in a small agrarian society, it's still unimaginable. Like the context, the consequences for power relations, for soil depletion, for resilience against future floods, all these things are incalculable. And so we have to use heuristics to make decisions. Also, things like price and brand are the heuristics that we have come up with for making those decisions. And I guess tribal identity being another one. And all of those have downsides, but they have the advantage of scaling while reducing cognitive load. And the question is, can we come up with a better system without excessively increasing the cognitive load? You still with me?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of, branding and pricing. You think about, counterfeits. So that's one of the downsides of that system, you know, that you can...
All of those things have counterfeits, just like, even at the human scale, the equivalent is the freeloader, the person who appears to be a good member of the community, but is actually only looks like they have the community's best interest in heart. In reality, they're hoarding, or they're shirking, or they're betraying.
Mm-hmm.
Right, is the counterfeit relationships. And the reality is that scale cuts both ways. Is that if you have too small of a sample size, then, like, on the one hand, many eyes make for sallow buds, right? Having a larger community makes it easier to find different kinds, identify different kinds of malfeasance or problems. But on the other hand, having a larger community also means you have less intimate knowledge of people, and therefore you have weaker signals to use. And, you know, it's kind of a weird trade-off between the two in terms of any given decision, which ones we prefer. In some cases, it's actually wiser to cast a wider net with weak signals, than a smaller net with strong signals because of the trade-offs. And so for me, the issue is less about scale than it is about transparency. Or, you know, I think the phrase hackability. The issue is, okay, I need to use these signals, whether they're short or large scales, distant from me, but there needs to be recourse, right? Which I guess really comes back to the issue of governance. Anyway, I'm still unclear. Anyway, that was a bit of a random tangent. I'm still unclear. So we like the idea of having a open network for people to choose to specialize with transparency somehow guaranteed. But then I'm still not clear what, and so, you know, the dream of a future where energy is, where say green renewable energy is limitless, has some attractions. I can think of some downsides, but what is the, I'm still not sure, actually sure how that connects to any of these other points.
To the industrialism and
industrialism, yeah.
Well, like you said, like or like this person that what's her name? Anyway, that industrialism is about making everything cheaper. You know, even human life, make you know, workers, you know, cheap labor, cheap. Mm-hmm. Products, you know, everything is cheap. Everything is cheap, and everything is valueless, or you know, mm-hmm. everything has little value. Well, we have to have the alternative is to live in a system where people value your life, your opinion, your knowledge, your experience. People know you. You're not anonymous. People know who you are, and they know. You know, but this is conflict transparency. They know what you say to people that your values are. You know, you say, I'm always for the truth. But they can also verify that. Like, all the research that he has done or she has done, all the activities reflect that this person is not duplicitous, is always honest, and that's good. That helps you, like you have a circle of friends, you know, that you can trust. You can trust them because they're your friends, you can trust them because you have dealt with them a long time. You can, trust is almost a calculation. You can, do I trust this person? Well, let's see what he has done, and I will come up with my level of trust.
Right. So we can use the word cohesion too to describe a group of people who have a really strong shared sense of identity, and you know have a high degree of trust within their community.
Yes, and then you scale that up to okay, you have a bunch of communities, and then they become the endpoints, and then you know if you have a large project that will benefit a set of communities. Then those communities, you know, can trust each other. Okay, this community has dealt with this other community for a while. They all have access to their, you know, their principles and their behaviors, and you can, you know, scale that up to now instead of individuals, you're dealing with communities that you know we both live in this area. We need to use the water from the river that we have, and instead of you know, everybody using all the water that they want. No, they can come up together and decide how much of the water to use. And it's not like, you know, whoever is upriver, they will just take all the water, because, you know, that's what the selfish systems that we have dictate. But no, if all of them are considerate of their large-scale families, right? If they're considerate of, you know, how our actions impact the other communities, then, you know, you live in a more direct and participatory relationship, where it's not, you don't have to say, we have to come up with things to punish those who do bad things, but more like, no, we just together find out what we need to do and cooperate to make that happen. So you
right,
you know,
but
you
I mean,
have,
currently, I mean, you know, in this world, you do still have bad actors, right? People who try to accumulate power, people who, do you think we will live in a world where we don't have bad actors or people who try to exploit the system?
Well, that's another aspect of, okay, what makes a bad actor? Why do these people, because everybody's, or most people, you know, unless you have...
I'll give you a really simple one. People differentially value the short-term interests of their local community over the short-term certain interests of the local community, weighing that against the long-term possible interest of the larger community, right? Is that, well, if I do this thing, it will help my family now for sure, and it may or may not hurt the larger community in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make those decisions based in a world of uncertainty?
Uncertainty being...
I don't know if this is actually... we don't know, right? The point is, like, if I... take this apple from a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I know that I will eat, and or my family will eat, which is great. Is it possible that if everyone took an apple from the tree, that we would lose our seed corns and, you know, the amount of the natural replenishment? Maybe, but unlikely, right? So individual actions, you know, have an uncertain long-term impact. I mean, fishing is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
Is that for generations, millennia even, you know, people would fish and they assumed that they were doing no global harm. And then suddenly we discovered, oh, wait, we finally get to a threshold where when everyone started doing it or certain people started doing it more efficiently, suddenly this thing, which was fine locally, has become damaging globally.
Hmm.
Right? Because the information of consequences and this is the real world, right? Is that there is great uncertainty about long-term consequences. And so reasonable people can disagree. Now, in the presence of good metrics and good science, you know, eventually you'd like to think we converge.
Mm-hmm.
And for some things we have, and some things we are fighting it against of it because of industrialized systems that people have bizarre suicidal convictions that lead them to deny evidence. But, you know, but the point is that there's lots of, even in a world of universal good intentions, there's lots of room for disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
And for differing trade-offs and different weightings.
And yeah, and that's true. To deal with that, that's where we have the transparency and historical information. So somebody, you know, like I said, we ate too many apples from the tree, now we're out of apples. So we can say, that would be a problem. That would be a mm-hmm. problem that it affects more than one community. Then the solution has to be, between those two communities or three communities, whatever. The mm-hmm. problem is elevated, and we have to, it should be easy to determine, okay, why did we run out of apples? Well, because
as a father who has two small children who are reasonably civilized human beings,
mm-hmm.
I cannot find out what's going on most of the time. Right, even though we are all around each other all the time,
mm-hmm.
Is that in any decision there's always hard decisions to be made where you don't have enough information. And that's just humanity. So let me actually kind of cut to the punchline, though. What Seth Godin said, he said, instead of using destroying our culture to feed industry, the alternative is to use industry and capitalism to serve culture. And I'd like to posit that the alternative to pastoralism and industrialism, what you're actually talking about, we could call culturalism, or maybe panculturalism. The idea is that we build a global culture, not that subsumes local varieties of culture, but in fact establishes new norms of behaving. That we say, oh, when we have a conflict, we resolve it in this way. Mm-hmm. And that we build a shared understanding of healthier versus unhealthier ways to resolve conflict. And we create a global pan culture where we can all sort of see what each other is doing and learn from and critique each other.
Exactly.
And that,
yes.
In a sense, but the way to do that is not directly by getting rid of things or picking winners and losers. The goal is to figure out what kind of culture we want to create. And then we create systems that of incentives that encourage and surface better cultural norms and encourage the adoption of them. And if you squint hard enough, you can actually see global capitalism as a really crude, really inefficient form of doing that. Because it created first a financial connection between the whole world, which, you know, has lots of sins to answer for, but it did prevent global war since the 1940s, which is something. And more impressively, it since the reforms of the 60s and 70s, it has also started to export environmentalism and fairer labor practices alongside the roads paved by capitalism, right? To be a Chinese worker at Foxconn, working for Apple, is, you know, no picnic, but compared to what it was, to life as a peasant laborer, going back to our original point, or to what it was before the transparency and accountability things flowed into that, it's way better than it was. And I'm not saying this to say that, to defend capitalism, but to say, you know, capitalism did give us a prototype for how this could be done. And the challenge is to, in fact, do something better. And I think moving away from industrialism to panculturalism and empowering peer production, but, you know, intelligently reusing the tools that worked is a way to get there.
Yeah, we can take the best or mechanical parts of capitalism and use that as a foundation for a better society. That with that, I agree, because there's little choice. You know, if you want to start a community outside of a city and, you know, do things yourself, you still have to deal with raw materials that you may have to buy. So that's where you have to touch the market in capitalism. But once you are safely removed from that, you can make your decisions, you know, like a family would make a decision.
I mean, I'm not sure you're ever really removed from that, though. I mean, right, is that if you wanted today to become, you know, Bear Grylls and live in the wild, you can. You can find a space that is not overly populated and make your living hunting and fishing and build your own clothes like a castaway. Very, very few people will choose to do so. Because very few people want to become competent in everything they need to survive. Most people much prefer to spend their energies focused on the things they care about and the people they care about, and use their surplus to have other people take care of the things they'd rather not invest in. And, you know, people already do barter. People already have living arrangements. And the difficulty is that right now the only shared global mechanism for connecting us is capitalism.
Yeah,
you know, Facebook, I guess, is getting close, but it doesn't really have the economic or the actually, to be fair, by leveraging the Facebook social graph, you actually have the sharing economy and people like that doing some stuff. But the fact of the matter is that, right, people, you know, want what they want, and to change what they want is really about changing culture. And we can't really live autonomously, and we don't really want to. I mean, that's going back to pastoralism, but we want to live mindfully, right? We want to be conscious of what we're doing and the consequences, and in relationship with people who will help us see our blind spots so we can do better at it.
Yeah, that's, you know, if you, and the reasons of my vision and my ideals is that I'm looking towards the day when we have settlements in different planets and, you know, we settle the solar system. So there are communities, you know, out in Titan or, you know, one of those moons or even circling, you know, even just station or whatever, that they must be autonomous when it comes to their, you know, their own life.
So there's a difference between autonomous and functionally self-sufficient and practically self-sufficient, right? Mm-hmm. So in terms of, yes, you need to be able to grow your own food and repair your own life support systems. Okay, those things are critical that people need to be able to manage themselves. Fine. But do they need to consume their own entertainment? You know, do they, you know, right? Is that, you know, luxury goods, entertainments, philosophies, things, education? One can easily imagine that they will often want to trade or barter these things. You know, just like the Romans sent their children to Greece to be educated, there will probably be for millennia, even after, or certainly centuries after this, a place where you say, you know, I want my children to go to Earth to get the best possible exposure to the planet's history. All right, did I cut you off? Did we die? Coming?
Hi. Sorry.
Probably a sign I was rambling too long anyway.
So, yeah, you were talking about even communities that are separated by long distances would need to trade in information or entertainment. Yes. Yeah, that is.
Yeah, my point is, that you want your critical life support systems to be locally managed, mm-hmm. but you. For the sake, and don't forget, the whole goal is to create pan-cultural. I think you want pan-culturalism. You actually want people to not become inwardly focused, self-supporting communes. I mean, we have groups like that today, and we usually call them cults, right? Because when they get into that small, narrow thing, it's actually much easier for charismatic individuals to impose harsh or unfair practices.
Well, another aspect of that. That is true, but then that's one of the main problems that we have. This culture of personality, we should move away from that situation.
Well, yeah, right. But the question, the way you do that, is not by allowing groups to become hermetically self-healed and self-supporting, right? Because there, the small amplitudes and variations of personality get amplified. That's why you want people connected into a global, you know, solar system-wide universal web of culture. Because you can say, wait, like, why am I letting Joe treat me like that when I see that in the rest of the world, you know, leaders are much more egalitarian? So there is, in fact, a necessity for these communities to be learning from each other.
Exactly. So that, you know, membership is, you know, you choose to be there. You don't live in the city just because I have no way to move out or whatever.
Yeah.
If you know that, you know, you live in this community, but there are there's another community out there that is more aligned with your values, you should be free to go over there. You know, it should be very fluid.
But you don't want to have zero barriers to exit, right? Because that way you don't want to make it, because the best way to ensure reliability is longevity in a community, right? Mm-hmm. If there's no possible downside to leaving, then you can easily flit around from group to group. And this is what internet trolls do, right? They go and create a new identity in each new community.
And that's another aspect of this. Now, sometimes somebody creates a community for a particular purpose. Let's also call it a company that creates a particular product, but then they changed for whatever reason. And then whoever was depending on that entity, they signed themselves without a product because the entity changed their values. So in one sense, once an entity, a community, loses its purpose, let's say they reach whatever purpose they had, you should be very transparent when it comes to, okay, we reach our purpose. So what are we going to do? If there's no purpose, they should, if they don't even have a set of values that keeps them together, it shouldn't exist. Once a community reaches its purpose, it has no reason to exist other than, you know, you have to come up with other purposes to create smaller communities.
Right. I think this is actually a good place to stop, because I think there's two really big deals, big issues that you're raising here. One is mobility, right? And then the flip side of that is loyalty. What is loyalty?
exactly.
You know, and I think that let's leave that as our topics for next week.
All right. Thank you, Ernest, for a great discussion.
All right. Thank you, Ernest. Really, really great discussion. Appreciate it. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay. Bye.